Welcome to another episode of In a Perfect World. This is your host, Rak Razam. I'm currently in transit on my globetrotting adventures around the world, following my shamanic pursuits, and I find myself, of all places, in a hotel room next to the Lima Airport. I've just returned from perhaps the most satisfying Ayahuasca Awakenings retreat I have led. It's been the fourth Ayahuasca Awakenings retreat I've led down to Peru. Since September last year, with a great group of people from all over the world, under the tutelage of Percy Garcia Lozano, my maestro shaman. And wow, what can I say? The mysteries of ayahuasca deepen the responsibility and the joy I find in facilitating and helping people awaken to their own inner nature, both within ceremony and without, with the workshops I lead, the lectures I give, and with the energetic work and the hands-on facilitation and ceremony are just really totally rewarding me. And I had my first pillow fight in ceremony, I must say. And that goes out to John, who does remember what happened. But the process of getting to know a person, getting to know what their needs are, getting to know what their blocks are, getting to know where they need help, is something I really enjoy. My own ayahuasca path is just remarkably deepening. And I must say that listeners of this podcast will remember that a few episodes ago I had Dr. Octavio Rettig, the Mexican Bufo alvarius toad shaman, on the show. And ever since he came to Australia and helped dispense his medicine to my local shamanic community, everyone has been completely irrevocably altered, and myself included. 10 days later, I went down for the April retreat and did ayahuasca, and I found that the 5-MeO-DMT from the toad, the Sonoran Desert toad, altered my vibrational field. It really was like an electric fence that was switched on, and it was just remarkable. And so, going into the ayahuasca space and the tryptamine space, I really noticed that I would go back to the light and back to the higher vibrational reaches of the celestial realms. I have quite a few ayahuasca downloads. I'm thinking in a few episodes I might try to collate them into a post-ceremony remix of some of the highlights when they're fresh, when the heart is beating and the life force is pulsing and the transmissions are coming thick and fast. For people that haven't been in an ayahuasca headspace or in a direct sort of entheogenic relationship with both their inner nature, their higher self, and with what that connects to, which I believe is the distributed consciousness and the collective consciousness of spirit itself, of the source itself, it really is such an immensely rewarding activity. I'm segueing quite a lot here, but this is all a bit of a build-up to today's episode, which I do believe is one of the, good Lord, my life just gets better and better. What can I say? Here I am in a hotel room in Lima. I've just come back from my latest ayahuasca awakenings retreat. I'm due in America to do some more writing work, some work with some film scripts, and then I'll be going down to Mexico in a couple of weeks to start a pilot episode documentary looking at Octavio Rettig and the 5-MeO-DMT Sonoran Desert Toad. And the reason I preamble for all of this is there's going to be another podcast, which I will eventually link this one to, coming out from Lorenzo Haggerty on the psychedelic experience, and tying all this together, tying into why I'm going on about 5-MeO-DMT so much, why it seems to be on the rise in the world at this moment, what it means entheogenically, what it means on a vegetal and both on, you know, the toad species and the human species, why all these things are dovetailing together at this point in time. And I've realized, I conducted this interview with Australia's own answer to Terence McKenna, the indomitable and the illuminating and the effervescent Dan Schreiber of Starseed Gardens, quite a while ago, probably almost a year ago now, and I only listened to this interview, again, grooming this for this podcast, months after the Octavio Rettig podcast, many months after the Martin Ball podcast, But I hope you, my listeners, will see that there is a pattern in all this. And it's not a linear pattern over time, even though these last three podcasts have been about 5-MeO-DMT. It's basically about what we're being shaped by as a culture and as a species as we reclaim our right relationship with nature and come back to the garden and come back to what the plants in the garden are connected to, which is the light and the relationship we are now reclaiming with the light as the entheogenic flowering and awakening cascades across the planet. So all of this is a bit of a preamble. Please, please, please go to rakrazam.com and subscribe. I'll be sending out regular monthly newsletters. And when my life calms down sometime, I'll get back to the bread and butter of trying to relaunch my website with a subscription model. So you will have lots of juicy interaction with me on an ongoing basis if you then choose to subscribe. And so I hope you do subscribe because, as you may have noticed over the last few episodes, things are really building to a really nice cohesion. I'm starting to see really how this big pattern comes together. And I really, really hope that you can stay with me on this journey because we're all in this together. We're learning together. This episode, I think you're going to find, is one of the most informative and illuminating and just ka-chink, ka-chink, when the penny drops episodes you've probably ever heard on any podcast. I highly recommend people interested in DMT, 5-MeO-DMT, ecology, spirituality, and their own awakening process. Listen to this episode. Take notes on this episode. Put into practice some of the thoughts around this episode. And this is what it's all about. I really hope that as a global entheogenic culture, we can start to work with the finer points of these modalities that we are rediscovering through minds like Dan Schreiber. So, what can I say? I am so grateful to you, my listeners, to Great Spirit, of course, to Percy Garcia, to all the Awakeners, and to the Toads. This one's for them. Without any further ado, I give you Dan Schreiber and the Dreamtime Toads at the end of time. Aloha.
So the story begins, as all good stories begin, at the beginning of time, which happens to be the end of time too. Is it the microphone over there, I think? Which happens to be the end of time. And the cyclical nature of time is obviously... I thought it's that side, but don't do it.
It's the audio out.
Okay. And the trick here is the illusion of time and how much mythology has been dedicated to the illusion of time. And it's in some of the psychoactive spaces where time collapses and we enter this infinite now place. And it's in that infinite nowness where everything's occurring all simultaneously that is described by many different cultures and many different peoples as... but from a modern Western perspective as like unity consciousness experience. And so the collapse of space and time is related to our perception of space and time. For example, wherever we go, there we are. We're present at that point, and it's always now. You know, if you have a watch that says now, it's never going to be wrong. Because it is always now for you at that point in time. And so we have these one body which lives in some kind of like biological time, which is kind of represented by Shiva's drum, you know, the tick-tock of time. And, you know, it's represented by these two Greek gods, Kyrios and Kronos. Kronos, where we get chronology, which is time, is this tick-tock of time in this linear fashion. Whereas Kyrios is related to the timing of things, the natural timing. When it's time for the leaves to turn orange and red and fall off in autumn, that's the time.
Do you spell Kyrios?
I think it's K-Y, but it could be K-I. And so we've got these two competing times, so to speak. And when we enter the psychoactive space, the deep psychoactive space.
So you're talking specifically the tryptamine space?
Not specifically, but the tryptamines is, it's really obvious, whereas a lot of the other psychoactive substances will give you different flavors. In other words, they'll look at the same thing from a different perspective, mm-hmm. but you get a generalized sense. And sometimes there's even this story where people will drink strong ayahuasca and feel like they rewired, and then they may take mushrooms again and feel like it's now transposed, like an ayahuasca-type mushroom experience.
Yeah.
So it's hard to tell, but the general experience of the collapse of space-time, which people report from high dosages of psychoactive substances, whether it's LSD or mushrooms or something like ayahuasca, is really alluded to as the possibility of what the dream time is. This uber creative period that the Aborigines of Australia talk about as the dream time, where huge amounts of linear time may have taken place, and yet they talked about in short periods. So biblical sense of God creating, you know, the whole universe and earth in 7 days, is that seven epochs? Mm. Or is it actual 7 days of the sun? You know, of course, our idea of a day is the sun rising and the sun setting, but of course the sun never rises or ever sets. Mm. The planet spins, and from a local point on the planet, as we revolve around, the sun seems to rise and set. And so which space-time are we talking about here in these epochs? So what I found really interesting was a few years ago I met Carl Kellerman, and he came over with his, his Mayan calendric story about how energy shifts across the globe from east to west in this process, and kind of logged in, you know, this Renaissance age in Europe and the flowering of that, and how it's like a temple step. In other words, it's accelerating as it's moving from east to west. And then, you know, you get the migration of the Puritans across and the discovery of America and the Americas, and then, you know, and the development of the East Coast, and then how that energy sweeps across to the West Coast, and then, you know, as the West Coast develops, and then, of course, bringing us to this huge explosion of consciousness awareness on the West Coast of the Americas in, in the 60s, and what that actually meant, you know, and...
So you're saying that the underpinning the geography of the 60s being located around the zero point of, you know, San Francisco, say, there was a reason for that energetic attraction of that
substance. Exactly. So the consciousness field is shifting there for that explosion or awakening of consciousness. And that's the stage that it set in the physical locality on the planet. That Kellerman mapped in his books is happening in the brain as well, in between the different hemispheres. And so at that point in time, on the West Coast, is discovered, you know, mushrooms and LSD and the whole summer of love. But what it was a meeting of East and West, where the West discovered the East. They discovered Tao and Zen Buddhism and, you know, India.
Consciousness was receiving more. So what is this consciousness field you mentioned then?
Yeah, so the planet is excreting what it needs to in forms of actual physical stuff so that it can coordinate this unfolding of consciousness. Now, when you describe it from a linear perspective, it doesn't make sense, because you either believe in providence or synchronicity, or you don't. And as a scientist, you know, that's all, if you're a hard scientist, that's all rubbish, you know. But if you step out of that role for a moment, you start to see that there is a synchronization of energy. And in this case, this time realm. And so what Kellerman was describing in his book, and we had a lot of interesting conversations around it, was how there was a natural flow that the Mayans were mapping and recorded in the shape of their pyramid about these epochs of time, which Terence McKenna alluded to through his own discoverings about his time wave zero theory ending in 2012 by his calculations. But what it essentially showed was that there was an exponential movement towards an inflection point, and at that point, things would change, and the half of evolution would maybe take place in the last second of time when we got to this this concrescence. Now, people who are familiar with the psychoactive or the strong psychedelic state know that they will go through within their own journey a reaching of point, and once you're coming to this climactic state where space-time collapses and you enter into this unity consciousness field, at that point of collapse, you pop out the other side and there's a big opening, and this field effect, if you could call it, is quite well documented by psychonauts, especially, you know, playing with the tryptamines. Now I'm going to shift gear. If we go to some of the more interesting theories about the evolution of the planet per se, there's a very interesting theory which I subscribe to, which is of an expanding Earth. So showing how the Earth at one stage was a particular size, which is much smaller than it is today. And this was in relatively recent history. We're talking hundreds of thousands or even a million years ago, as opposed to billions of years ago. And so it's very easy to see how Africa was once joined to South America, because even a kid could see how it's joined. What's not as easy to see is that the continents joined on the Pacific side as well. But because of the spread, it's much harder to see. But if you take all the continents, and there's a beautiful animation on YouTube by a guy, I think, called Adams. And if you Google, expanding Earth, you'll see how in this eloquent animation, you see how all the continents fitted together. Mm. And so what's interesting in the story I'm telling is from the Origines, and I'm talking about the Australian Origines here, their talk about the dreaming beginning in Australia, beginning, I think, on the east coast of Australia.
Okay, so wait a sec. So at the start you were talking about this dream time and unity consciousness, but we didn't really define... Well, I guess that is the definition of what the Aborigines define as the dream time as well.
Yeah, so at the moment I'm loosely referring to the dream time as that psychedelic space, you know, that people drop into where there's a total loss of a concept of space and time. There's just this ever-present nowness. And so what the Aborigines were talking about from the dream time is in ancestral time, when the Earth comes into being, was the zero point in terms of space-time for that was this east coast of Australia. So then...
East coast specifically.
Yeah, then there's this long unfolding of energetic time as it sweeps across from east to west, you know, through, let's say, China, you know, and Japan in that line, and then sweeping through to Asia, you know, and then through Africa.
It's going around the globe, huh?
And then, you know, and Africa and Europe, and then bang, into the east coast of the Americas. It's accelerating now and accelerating, and then the west coast of America, and then bang, it's
coming back to us.
That's right. And so the full circle, or the end of one dreaming and the beginning of the next one is due now. Because in the expanding Earth, you'll see that the lands are connected and the oceans are relatively new. You know, the land underneath the oceans is like 200,000 years old.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's very, very new relative to the land on the land, the continents.
Yeah, yeah.
And so imagine this time band unfolding. So Australia used to be connected to South America in this model. And what's interesting is that the cane toad itself is endemic to the jungles.
Could I just ask, we're talking about the east coast of Australia. What's
and I understand that the consciousness and the coming full circle, in the physicality of the land on the East Coast, how does that relate to tryptamines, and what's the connection and what's the anchoring point for...
Well, so in the dreaming, the ancestors, the Origini ancestors, were playing out these stories, hunting and gathering and, you know, animals fighting and dueling, and they shape the landscape. But they actually become the landscape. And so they become the lakes and the mountains and all the plants and the animals, all evolve out of the dreaming of these ancestor beings as they dream these... the landscape into being.
But are you using a different sense of the word dreaming here? You're like a story?
Yeah, so the dreamtime stories will maybe allude to, well, that mountain there was when this guy went hunting, you know, and he threw his boomerang and it knocked the kangaroo out, and as the kangaroo's tail swished, it formed that mountain range, you know? And so you get this idea of this massive scope of creation of these giant beings. But... again, when we look at that through a rational, logical mind, it doesn't make sense. It only makes sense in the deep psychoactive space when we're hearing the stories and we're going, oh, okay, this story is about this other thing, because we could dream whole worlds sitting in our front room, you know, and experience whole worlds. Where do they come from? You know, where does the light come from in a dream? And this is where we come to... the brain chemicals like dimethyltryptamine.
Give it to me, dear.
Okay. So there's a story that the body is hardwired to go through this natural evolutionary, involutionary experience and initiatory experience. And so some people have talked about doing a dark room retreat, and of course that's documented in many different cultures around the world. But
what is that?
The dark room retreat is essentially an isolation in total darkness for 14 days and 14 nights, but can be much longer. And so the first thing that happens is the first 3 days, the body, being in darkness, starts to produce large amounts of melatonin. And melatonin is the hormone of darkness. This corresponds to dark, and what it does is it reheals the tissues, but it also aligns the circadian rhythms. So that's why people take melatonin today to recover from jet lag, because of the time shift. So it resets the circadian rhythm clock back to day and night cycles. So the first few days, your body's producing this melatonin, and it's going through preparing the physical body, going through a healing process, but also getting rid of all the preconceived ideas of time. Mm-hmm. And of course, melatonin is related to melanin, and which is the color of our pigment in our skin in relation to light, like sunlight. Mm-hmm. So the more sunlight you have, the more your skin will produce more melanin, the better protected you will be from that light. And so therefore, there's a story that the high levels of melatonin of the peoples of Africa, for example, the Negroid races, are due to their particular relationship to light.
Mm.
Okay. So before I stray too far, I'm coming back to this dark room retreat. The first few days, your body's producing melatonin. After melatonin, the body produces... pinoline, which is from the pineal, and this is the body's own MAO inhibitor. Now, MAO inhibitor does a very specific job. What it does is it prepares the body for the acceptance of the tryptamines, and it also acts as an antidepressant. What it's actually doing is loosening the actual physical stuff, or preparing the tissues for this next thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so for people who don't know, when you make up a brew of ayahuasca, what you're doing is you're taking these brain chemicals called tryptamines, but what it enables them to be orally active or active in your system is taking an MAO inhibitor. Now, you can have an MAO inhibitor, and if you've got a rich source of tryptamines naturally in your body, you'll experience the psychoactive state.
But I thought the MAO was because of the stomach going through the gut, you know, delivery. So if the pineal gland secretes this thing with an MAO, but that's from the brain.
Yes.
Why does it need to have an MAO from the... It's flushing it into the body, the MAO.
That's flushing it into the body, but it's only because you've now been 6 to 8 days in the darkness,
mm-hmm.
and it's prepared the body with the melatonin, then it's preparing the body for the next cascade, the next hormone,
right.
which happens to be 5-MeO-DMT.
Mm-hmm.
So then the body starts to produce 5-MeO-DMT, which Terence McKenna referred to as the Tyrannosaurus Rex of tryptamines, because it literally is the most powerful brain chemical, or one of the most powerful psychoactive substances known to man. Now, what that does in the body, it seems to be, is it seems to actually tear open the body armor. So all the built-up preconceived ideas of who we are that are out of resonance with existence, they held in the body as trauma and body armor. In other words, it could have happened as a kid. We could have been abused. There could be all levels of abuse happening on all sorts of things. But any out of alignment of the idea of who we think we are with what actually is creates a stress and a tension in the body. And that's held by a certain stiffness. And generally, as people get older, unless they have a particular practice, they'll become stiffer and stiffer. And according to like Chinese traditional medicine, the stiffer you get, the slower the qi moves through your body, and where it pools and stagnates, that's where you get that stagnation can lead to, the cancers.
Right.
Because the qi is no longer moving, and so the tissues can start to die because they cannot take up enough oxygen and energy.
This helps me understand that this tryptamine flush that's happening in the body and the cascading chemical cocktails are designed to keep us healthy and in good flow and in
exactly. So the different cultures that do this, whether they are in Tibet or Nahuatl shamans in Mexico or the Kogi, the reason they do this is a default setting. In other words, you take away all the external distractions and the body starts to go through its own automatic default reset.
So when the brain starts to get to the 5-MeO stage, they've done the research into death, near-death experiences, do you go to that level of experience?
Apparently. Mm. Okay.
Maybe more, yeah.
So once you go through the reset of the 5-MeO-DMT, which really is starting to soften and break apart the body armor, because that's actually preparing for the last brain chemical in this cascade, which is the hormone of light. So we started with the hormone of dark, which is melatonin. We moved through the natural MAO inhibitor, then the 5-MeO-DMT, which is preparing the body, and now the DMT, which is the hormone of light. And all through nature, this is the molecule that's being looked at, but of course, it's just the catalyst.
So this is NN-DMT?
Yeah.
Right, so it comes forth. Hmm. Interesting.
And then people experience like a full ayahuasca type experience on, between day 10 to 14. And so what's actually happening is just through isolation and darkness, you're going through a body, moves from the hormone of darkness through to the hormone of light and does this reset. And then you can come out, it's like an ayahuasca type experience, and there's a reset.
And so it switches off after when you come back into the light.
That's right.
Do you think, say, the switches off thing, it's a certain days, it's got a built-in time frame to it.
Built-in time frame, exactly.
The cascading starts to happen. I'm interested because the NN-DMT happened in stage 4, not at stage 3, when 5-MeO is often considered in psychedelic culture is the light on top of the Christmas tree. It's as far as you can go. But it happens, it's happening because it's working on the body, not necessarily going to that.
Yeah, and it depends on the people, Some people may need, that's where their stuff stuck.
Yeah.
But it's interesting at this point to note the difference between ayahuasca and yahe.
Yeah, right, okay.
Because ayahuasca has the MAO inhibitor and the NN-DMT. And yahe...
Just give us the full technical thing, the Banisteriopsis carpi and
so ayahuasca traditionally, when you boil it down to its base plants, is two plants. One is Banisteriopsis carpi, and the other is Psychotria viridis. So you know, your ayahuasca vine and your chakruna, and one supplies, let's say, the power, and the other the light. And the light, in this case, is this this light I'm talking about, this ethereal light, which is the same light that is what illuminates your dreamscapes. There's obviously no actual light bulb or sun, and yet in a dreamscape there's light. Where does that light come from?
Is that just a representation of light, or you're saying it's actually light?
What's the difference?
I don't know.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So there is an idea that I think has been evolved through different people, but David Wilcox is describing that, you know, the pineal is a vestigial eye, a third eye.
Literal third eye, yeah.
And that it can actually pick up light that's a quantum type of light. Mm-hmm. So light from anywhere and focus it on the screen of the pineal gland.
Mm-hmm.
So there are these little crystals in there that will alter as different photons of light hit it, but it doesn't have to be the straight in the visible spectrum.
Mm.
Okay, so the difference between the ayahuasca, which is the vine and the chakruna, and the yahe, which is two Malpighiaceae vines, one is Banisteriopsis carpi, or the ayahuasca vine, and the other vine, which has many different names, but the botanical name is Diplopteris cabarana.
Mm.
And this looks similar to an ayahuasca vine. And so this is now two vines growing together, or like a caduceus.
Mm.
And the main difference is that this vine has, along with the MAO inhibitor, which comes from the Banisteriopsis carpi, the yahe vine has 5-MeO-DMT, DMT, NN-DMT, and bufotenine. Now, this is important to notice.
Can I ask which tribes use yahe versus the tribes that use ayahuasca in general regional?
Colombia, there's lots of yahe drinkers. Mm-hmm. Down through parts of Ecuador, on the border of Brazil and Peru, there's quite a few tribes that drink yahe. Mm-hmm. And
okay.
Yahe is generally regarded as more powerful than,
because it has the two,
because of the 5-MeO, more powerful than DMT on its own.
Mm.
Because it has this part that I think is what grounds that spiritual visionary state. In other words, one is like going to the movies and seeing the visionary pictures. Another is like embodying that and going, well, how am I going to make this work in my day-to-day life?
Mm. Right.
So the contrast between the regular ayahuasca and yahe is best expressed by a lot of the missionaries that were there. You know, and yahe was referred to as like the dog's ayahuasca, because that would be the one that would really kick you, drag you through the mud kind of thing, and make you realize that your whole religious thing was possibly just, you know, on a scale of what was actually going on. And so it was the one that was most feared, because it, you know, the ayahuasca could be looked at and seen from a perspective and then go, well, this is true or this is not true, or, you know, whereas once it was in the body and actually working the body, there was no denying that it was re-sculpting the way in which the body was actually wired.
Right. And so it has the bufotenine.
This has bufotenine, which is really interesting, because through the there was an interesting association of toads and toad medicine with the Maya. And there was, there's a lot of pottery and artifacts that have toads. And so there is suggestion that toads were being used, and there were special vessels to hold toads, whether they were actually being brewed, we're not sure.
And that's in the Maya culture?
Yes.
In Mesoamerica?
Yes. And then what happens is, so I happened to be in round about 2000 in the Shipibo village of San Francisco, drinking tea with Don Martin, who was about 80 at that stage, and I believe he's no longer alive, but he made this quite an extraordinary brew, and it was an ayahuasca brew. And we were sitting in a maloca maybe 50 meters from the river, and at any time of day or night up and down the river, these river boats would be, you know, plying their trade or traveling, and they've got that long outboard motor, you know, on a stick, and as the sound of the motor would bounce off the trees, you know, it was that, you know, that kind of like diesel thumping. And so this would go on at, you know, through the evening. And I remember I was sitting with Don Martin and my friend Trevor, who I met there, who was doing a 6 months initiation, an apprenticeship. And so the medicine started to get stronger and stronger, was coming on, and I heard what I thought was a boat traveling along the river, and it turned and came towards us, and then it became two boats, and then four boats, and then 100 boats seemed to be coming towards us, but there was no river. And so I was like, you know, what the hell's going on here? And I was recording this with my mini disc recorder. And what I realized as the boats approached, that it wasn't boats, that it was actually the toads singing, making that sound, which is really similar. They're like, "Durr." You have to press. Is it still rolling?
Usually it starts a new one, but it says it's still going.
Okay. So the boats are now streaming towards us, and I realize they're toads, but as the sound actually sweeps over us, much like the sound we can hear in the background of the cicadas, it comes across in a wave, and as the wave washed over the maloca, the forest, it was like someone turned on a floodlight. You know, the forest just lit up. Now, it was in different shades of orange, I believe. And so there was, you know, it was very bright. And I realized that the sound of the toads somehow affected the activation of the medicine in my body. As if the sound of the toads were carrying the sound signature related to the vine. In other words, much like a shaman may make a sound or use a sound like an ikaro to either tune into a particular spiritual realm or the song or ikaro of a particular plant that is going to access that spiritual energy for use in healing or divination, the toad itself had a sound that could ratchet us into a different dimension. Now, I knew it was the sound of the toad because I'd lived with toads many years before. When I lived in London, I had a warehouse, and in round about 1990-91, Terence McKenna had come over, and you know, we were chatting in the front room, and he was talking about, you know, toads and Bufo virus and Bufo marinus. Bufo virus is the Colorado River toad, and Bufo marinus is the cane toad.
What about the Sonoran Desert toad?
That's what the Sonoran Desert toad is the Colorado River toad.
Oh, right.
Bufo virus,
right,
which has a long history of usage. And so what happened was really interesting. I was living with the toads, and at that stage I was experimenting with, psilocybin and mescaline, and what would invariably happen is the toads would hide away during the day, and at night they'd hop around and eat insects. And when myself or other people were on high doses of these psychoactive substances, at the peak, the toads would come out and sing. And at first, this was one of those synchronous things like, wow. But what was amazing was as they would sing, that sound would actually ratchet the visions into a very specific place. It would drive the visionary process.
Frog Ikaro.
Frog Ikaro. Or the sound of bufotenine.
sound of bufotenin?
I don't know. Mm. But the bufotenin, it sits in the parotid glands. And this is the stuff that people are saying is poisonous. And yet it's poisonous to all animals except humans. The human body is psychoactive.
Specifically in the cane toad? In the bufotenin?
Yeah. So in bufotenin is what's in the big glands just, you know, on the neck, kind of by the ears. Those two big bulges, they are filled with this stuff called bufotenin. Now, if you're a dog and you bite into a cane toad, it shoots out kind of like a pimple being squeezed so that the toad doesn't eject it on its own. It's only ejected from actual pressure. Mm. But if the toad gets bitten, it can release some of this bufotenin and it can be toxic to animals. But to humans, it's psychoactive. And what's interesting is it's synergistically psychoactive. In other words, it's psychoactive on its own, but when combined with other brain chemicals like NMDMT and 5-MeO-DMT, the psychoactivity is amplified. It's a synergist.
Mm. Are you thinking this is related to, I mean, it wasn't in the cascading four chemicals of the brain, the bufotenin was?
That's right.
It's not endogenous to the human.
As far as I know, it's not endogenous.
But it amplifies endogenous
dopamine. But it seems to synergize these, the two endogenous tryptamines. And they may find some chemical in the human body that is like bufotenin. I don't know.
Mm. So what do you think it does in the frog? Why is it there in the frog?
Good question. So what I experienced that night was sitting with Don Martin in the Maloca was this incredible sound of toads. Me being in a space where I didn't recognize them at first, I thought they were boats. Mm. Then, because I'd had this association of living with the toads and recognized that every time we were in high states of or in unity consciousness, the toads would come out and sing. You know, so when it happened a few times, we realized that they were very tuned into this particular state, this particular type of consciousness, and would react to it.
So what do you say? So it implies that the vibrational code of bufotenin not just amplifies other tryptamines, but has a synergistic relationship with them and is attracted and drawn out and wants to connect with them in nature. Because it's doing it in you. The code is drawn to you as a part of nature, just as it would in the ecosystem, perhaps.
Right. So, again, the lines in this dreaming space, in the psychoactive space, become blurred between us and those plants, us and those animals, us. In other words, the jaguar shaman, the jaguar eating the ayahuasca, is a jaguar. But in an altered state of vision, that's a jaguar shaman. You see? So here the toads have now made this journey, you know, from the jungles of the Amazon. They were taken to Hawaii.
I just wanted to ask, when you're on another substance like psilocybin or something, or an NDMT, and the frog sings this bufotenin trigger activating sympathetic thing, what is that imprint of the bufotenin frequency imprinting on your existing consciousness already on a tryptamine? What does it do? What are you experiencing? You're saying it's amplified into your vision?
It drives the vision. You know, like if you take a low dose of DMT, you can go into a realm that's kind of like the psycho clown realm,
yeah.
You know, with bright fluoro colors, and then more you'd push past that and you go into a different realm. In other words, there's specific realms at specific vibrational frequencies. Mm. And once you reach a certain thing, you rapidly move through these, I'm going to call them lower, but they're not lower, but these lower frequencies into a high frequency. Mm. But what the toads seemed to be able to do was to actually, with its sound, drive through to these higher frequency realms. Mm. Now, this was just my experience living in London with the toads. But here it was again, when I was drinking ayahuasca with Don Martin and Trevor in the Maloca in San Francisco.
So you're about to explain the bufotenin or the frog's role in the South American ecosystem.
Well, no. So what happened was, as the sound came on, the light turned on. It was if like there was lights in the forest, like the orange, you know, those old tennis court lights that start off orange and then get, you know, like a metal halide type thing. In the early stages, it was just like this orange glow. And I could hear the different sounds of, you know, night insects singing, night birds, night frogs singing. And immediately the trees started to talk, and they were going, this is our... They were talking through these insects, the insects that were living off the trees, sucking the saps of the trees, and the frogs eating those insects had the message or the wisdom of the trees. And as they were singing the praises or the story of the tree.
Mm.
So as I started to hear this, this was now like obviously in full blown.
So what if the dream time is not a story, it's a song?
It is a song. Okay. And so what happened was the trees started to each to tell me their different stories. But then all the sounds became like just one sound. In other words, it was a symphony. And at that moment of recognition of the sound being the perfected, perfectly synchronous or providential sound, at that point I experienced like a dropping into this unity consciousness state, which was very profound, to say the least. It was only when I came back 6 months later, and I was in the rainforests in Upper Wilson's Creek behind Byron Bay, that I pulled out this mini disc and decided to play the mini disc. And I put the mini disc in the mini disc player and pressed play, and it was this particular session that I hadn't heard since that time. And immediately as the toads started to sing, I went into vision. And this was, you know, pretty strong because I hadn't actually taken anything.
But you've got them naturally occurring in your brain, and if bufotenin in the soundscape activates it, it should replicate that.
To explain it, phytochemically or scientifically, it would be speculation. But all I know is I went into vision, and there was an Amazonian Indian man standing in front of me with his hands cupped, and he said, this is a gift for you for the end of time. And he opened his hands, and there was a toad sitting in his hands, and then the toad jumped out and landed on Australia, like on the continent of Australia. And as the toad jumped in midair, it became two toads and landed, jumped again, became 4, 8, 16, onwards and onwards. There was this obvious idea of like the toad being introduced to the land of Australia. And in a series of visions, I was shown how the toad arriving in Australia was part of the toad bringing the sound signature of the tryptamines to awaken the acacia fields.
So as I just to give a historical riff, the toad was introduced to Australia.
The toad was taken from the Peruvian jungles to Hawaii to control the sugarcane beetle. Now, it's a very interesting, it was a failure in Hawaii, because the cane beetle was actually up here, and the toads were jumping on the floor, and they were in two different areas. They couldn't eat them. It was a disaster. Didn't work. And then they got all these toads. So I don't know what actually happened historically as to how they then thought that it would work here.
For the same reason for beetles here.
For the same reason that it didn't work in Hawaii.
Or the Hawaiians didn't tell them it didn't work and they just wanted to ship off the beetle.
Possibly. I have no idea. But so the toads that we got came from Hawaii, but they would have originally come...
World War II?
I think around about that time.
We can look it up, but... So they introduced the toad here in Australia to control a pest, which
in the sugarcane fields. And so then the toad comes to Australia, and it's interesting because a lot of the acacias, Australia's rich with acacias, and acacias are rich with tryptamines, and so this is well documented. But along the eastern seaboard, there's a particularly rich, not only diversity, which gives you an idea of how long the acacias have been around, but a particular number, like a huge number, and a huge amount of really interesting chemicals. And from the Origine perspective, these were the medicine trees. The dreaming ancestors literally became these trees, and that's part of their medicine for the people. But what this Indian was telling me when he released the toad was that the toad was going to herald through its sound the beginning of the end of time. And the beginning of the new time. In other words, the same story of the collapse of one dreaming time, or the birth of the death of one realm and the beginning of another, the end of one dream time and the start of the next.
But they don't consider the current his story a dreaming time. The other is still a dreaming time.
It is. It's just one culture's perception of what's going on.
Okay. It's a filter.
Okay. Yeah, and so I thought that this was maybe what was going to be happening in 2012 because of the whole pressurized build up. You know, of people taking stories and saying, well, it's the Maya and they're going to do this and 2012 is going to be this point. And of course, this was happening in 2001. And so I had this assumption that that was a reference to that point in time.
It's not a point, it's a process, isn't it?
It's a process, yeah. Exactly. But what we do know is now that the toads are rapidly spreading across the north end of Australia and down the eastern seaboard.
And they've been doing that for decades, though.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's travelling further and further south, and there's more and more numbers, or reaching a saturation.
And so to reiterate, what you believe they're doing in the ecosystem is activating...
The acacias.
The acacias.
So imagine there's this rich source of tryptamines in the acacia. And one of the things that activates it in a very specific way is this bufotenine. Mm. And now, all of a sudden, there's this huge amount of bufotenine being introduced energetically, frequency-wise, into the mix. Mm. And so what this man was telling me was that the end of time and the beginning of new time was going to be heralded by the saturation of this dreaming field. In other words, the collaboration between the toads and the acacias was going to start allowing the seeping of these brain chemicals from the environment into the atmosphere, so much so that all the people would start to enter into this dreaming type space that we were talking about, the psychoactive space.
Do you think it might not
without taking the DMT?
Physical atmosphere, but etheric atmosphere.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And essentially saying that time would start to collapse and become more and more trippy as we...
Non-linear
or quantum.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that people didn't have to take this somacacia or acacia and toads and MAO inhibitors. They just had to be in the field of it. And then that would sweep again across the planet and birth a new dream time. And this is coinciding also in what's going on with the sun, and it's coinciding in what's going on with the popularization of ayahuasca per se on the planet at this time, which is what I was referring to earlier. It's not that the popularization of ayahuasca brings around this type of consciousness, but this type of consciousness starts to rise, and then all of a sudden people discover the external catalysts, and then those external catalysts then start to inform the process of reculturalization, definition of what our cultural relationship is between ourselves, each other, and the landscape. And
so there's a macro object, which is the planetary organism you're describing, which is us, and in microcosm we have the cascading tryptamines in our brains which can be activated.
Yes.
And then there's also that in the ecology as well.
That's right.
And the synergy between us and the frogs and the environment is what's all activating to bring in the dream time.
Correct. And then if you go back to Steiner talked about all of this in an evolutionary and involutionary process. And so... The earth was born out of the sun, and the relationship, the electromagnetic relationship between the sun and the earth, or the love relationship between the sun and the earth, bore the children, or an excretion out of the earth. Its first children were the plants.
Species.
It was probably the bacteria.
Oh.
But I would say that the bacteria and then fungi and then plants were the children of the sun and the earth, the first children. Mm. And then they prepare the earth for the succession of the next realm, of the animal realm. And then once human being has unfolded its physical body, then it can step into its own physical body and walk around in its greater physical body, which is the story of Steiner's cosmology of humans coming to Earth. In other words, humans were the first beings to come to Earth, but the last beings to take physical form. And out of human being unfolded the mineral kingdoms, the plant kingdoms, the animal kingdoms, and then human.
Right.
So it's very interesting that he describes it that way, because that's kind of how the dreaming stories tell a story.
Mm.
And so now we're at this threshold of a new dreaming, and the humans awakening in its human body to what it is to be human and dreaming a new dream.
What is it to be fully human? Is it to be plugged into the planetary organism as this collective consciousness?
Well, it's the animalistic side of human, which is its connection to its body and its earth, which has grown with the earth and all its organisms over billions of years, is that biological awareness and consciousness, which is the immune system and the default sets of consciousnesses that animals, that we call instinct, that animals and the human body has. You know, you touch something hot, the default instinct is to pull away from the pain. So that's the body's natural, you could call it instinctive process. Being human is awakening to the idea that there's an immortal spiritual avatar inhabiting that biological skin suit and lending its energy to that skin suit in a very specific way, so that skin suit can perform its function as a custodian on Earth. And part of that custodianship is not only to regulate an interface between this love relationship between the sun and the earth. In other words, guide and become custodians to the plants, the animals, the minerals, and the elements. But to actually cycle that energy back to the sun in a higher form. So to become human is to awaken to that purpose. And the way in which humans do that is through love. Through the generation of love in their body, they are literally infecting all the plants and animals and other realms with a higher frequency. In other words, they're taking the living frequency of light of the sun that's growing everything, and they taking that and upgrading it. So you can eat a meal, okay, and veg out at watching television, or you can eat a meal and make a prayer or write a song. Mm. Either way, the energy as it liberates from your body in the form of, let's say, thought and awareness can have all different levels of frequency. But the higher levels of frequency that are associated with what we call love are actually encode and entrain all other life and are quantum. So they're very, very powerful. They don't just extend just beyond the human body itself. Mm. They actually extend into different space-time realms. Just like you think of your mother, she's on the other side of the world, and she may go, oh, and get a warm, fluffy feeling, call you up and go, oh, hi, how are you going? Oh, I was just thinking about you. So that field, that love field, can move backwards and forwards in time and backwards and forwards in space. In other words, distance is no object for that field.
I mean, you think that love's like the buffeting of the, you know, it's the same relationship it activates and amplifies, and when we feed it back, you know, it's like...
Right, and you know, like when I first discovered ayahuasca, there were so many stories, for example, of, you know, someone being in an ayahuasca journey and becoming, let's say, an eagle and flying over, you know, New York City and seeing their girlfriend painting, you know, and seeing their girlfriend look up and, you know, then coming back, you know, weeks later, speaking to her saying, oh, this happened and I saw you and you're painting this painting and it's amazing. Oh my God, there's the painting. And she's going, oh my God, while I was painting that, I looked up and there was this light and I didn't know what it was. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Mm. So this quantum, what you call magic,
yeah,
is quite well described in these realms as stories. Can they be scientifically corroborated? Who knows? Yeah. But there are more and more stories of staunch believers who are changing because of this process. In other words, what we call a Gnostic vision or a direct perception means that we can actually remote view. You know, we can actually use our bodies as a diagnostic tool and an X-ray vision into another body. Mm. We can use telepathic communication. These may actually all be hardwired into the body.
Mm. To bring it back in and round it off, so what happens at the end of time? A new cycle of dreaming begins?
Yeah, a new cycle of dreaming begins. Alluded to in the Hopi prophecy rock, which is, at this point in time, there's a split. Now, we don't know whether that split goes both ways or it's one or the other. In other words, in prophecy rock, it spirals into death and doom and destruction, you know, maybe thermonuclear war, ecological destruction, death of the planet. Yes, yeah, so the extinguishing of one dream in as a just a destructive spiral into hell, right? And the other is this quantum leap into this golden age, which may take many, many years to reach, may take hundreds of years for all we know, but a definite turning point. And so whether it splits and we get both, or whether it's a one or the other, we don't know. This is the big, one of the big perennial philosophical questions.
This is one of the 2012 sort of, you know, hippie sort of hopes that we would have some type of verifiable, concrete, evolutionary upgrade of the species related to DMT, pineal, all that cosmic stuff. Are you saying it's still on the cards? It's still happening?
It is still happening, but not... I think what was happening at that time was people were trying to look at I don't want to use the word psychedelic, but a holographic visioning and dream awakening from a linear mind.
Yeah.
And so they're still in that mindset of Kronos, of Shiva, that it tick-tock, so it's got to be on this date at this time.
Mm.
And that's not how it works. This is more in the realm of Kyrios.
Mm.
This is the divine timing of when it's time, it's time.
Mm.
And interestingly enough, when I was in South Africa at this Science, Consciousness and Ancient Cultures conference, there was a couple of the speakers talking about a particular destruction that occurred about 12,500, 13,000 years ago. And one of the speakers talked about a huge plasma discharge from the sun that effectively fried most living things on Earth, except beings that could hide underground.
And, you know, the frog's an amphibian, it can go into the water. So, yeah.
So whether that is potentially what's about to happen again with the sun in relation to human awareness on the planet, if they don't get their shit together, or, you know, or there's a possibility, and from what I see, more likely a probability, that there is an awakening that's sweeping really quickly across the planet, and that humans will very soon start to see that the idea of a techno-savior, that we will somehow be liberated or saved by technology, I think they'll realize that that's actually a false myth that's been implanted, and that the true awakening is really to the awakening of who we truly are already, that we already are the culmination of this technology, which turns into this bio-wetware that's super sophisticated, and that the Earth and in fact the human body is already at the pinnacle of that type of evolutionary, story. So the idea is not to build technology to save the world, but to build technology as a training wheel to teach us about the technology of what the body is, so that we can then reference back to the body as this ultimate technology. I mean, think about it. The cells are immortal. with feeding them the right sort of energy, the right nutrients, they could go on indefinitely and constantly change and constantly upgrade. So the body itself, being at this threshold of biological exquisite evolution, has the potential to do all this incredible stuff, as we see when we engage with this plant or this plant, the realms that can be visioned and created, what humans are capable of when they work in a group with a combined vision. It's incredible what humans have done and what they can do. You know, and we can build the physical monuments like the pyramids, but we can also build whole other worlds through our visioning process and using sound to flesh out that visioning process. And, you know, essentially our highest realm or our highest role of being humans on the planet may be that. Maybe for us to allow our bodies to act as a bridge or a divine anchor for love to physically manifest on the planet. So our relationship to the animals and the plants and the minerals are to use that body to capture this, enchant this light, and then as it's liberated back through us, through our songs and our prayers and our meditations, we send it back to the sun in a higher form so that the spiral can continue, constantly getting higher.
Beautiful. That's the toad at the end of the dream time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dan Schreiber. It's a wrap.
Thank you, Rack.